Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Stephen Shaw, 29 years of combination experience, former Assistant Chief of Training, EMS, Mobile Integrated Health, and Professional Development for Fort Lauderdale Fire Rescue. Currently Deputy Fire Chief for Jupiter Fire Rescue, which goes live in 2026. Like so many others I've been fortunate to interview, the fire service wasn't on Stephen's radar. It was his dad who became interested in the profession and grabbed Stephen to go on the same ride with him. After that, the rest, as they say, was history. The conversation Stephen and I had revolved around a few of his passions, which include caring for our boots on the ground, letting them know that they're valued and appreciated, training and how with this profession must go hand in hand, and finally, how your work ethic will speak volumes for those around you. With that, I present Mr. Stephen Shaw.
Well, hello, my name is Steve Shaw. I am the Deputy Fire Chief for the Town of Jupiter Fire Rescue Department. Got into the fire service early when I was 18 years old. And what started it was my dad. At 18, we lived in Coral Springs. And he's like, yeah, one day after high school or right at the end of high school, he goes, hey, you know what? Let's go join the volunteer fire department. And at the time, I was so busy. I had scouts and work and school and everything else, soccer. And I'm like, Dad, I don't have time for this. And basically, my dad guilted me into starting. He's like, you know, you're going to do this with me. I'm like, okay, let's figure it out. And I'm so glad he gave me that push to be exposed to the fire service at that age, because after a very short time, I just realized this is what I want to do with the rest of my life. So was a volunteer for 2.5 years with Coral Springs Fire Rescue. Got my first paid job at 20 in Deerfield Beach Fire Rescue, worked there for a year and a half. Really wanted to do hazmat, so I took a position in Fort Lauderdale in August of 99, and I was in Lauderdale so just recently for just shy of 25 years. Left there as the assistant chief over EMS training, professional development, and then mobile integrated healthcare. And now I get this wonderful opportunity now to help start a fire department from the ground up here in the town of Jupiter. So that is a very short nutshell of a path where I'm at right now. I've got just shy of 30 years in the fire service, and I love it. I'm more excited today than I've ever have been, and I'm so glad to be in the fire rescue service.
Okay. Did your dad continue with being a volunteer, or did he stop somewhere as you pretty much took off or ran with it?
So interesting story. My dad's a special breed. He was, I guess, 45 and when we got into the volunteers together. And after I started realizing this is what I want to do with my career, he just decided to go to school too. So he did fire academy, he did EMT school, and finished paramedic school all in the same time frame that I did. So at 47 years old, he was a fully certified firefighter paramedic in the state of Florida. And the story he always tells me, because he was working at the city of Miami at the time as a facilities manager in the same building that the city manager worked. And one day after he was finishing all his school, he always says that the city manager came up to him one day. And he's like, Steve, what are you doing? What are you doing here? Why are you going to fire school? And I guess the way he tells it is, the city manager says, listen, how about we give you Fridays off in a company car? He goes, okay, I'll stay. So he went all to school just to kind of do the school. But he tells us today that it was more of like just to show us he could do it, to do it with us as a father-son type thing. So yeah, he kept doing it. He was volunteering with me for a while. It was always interesting going on calls with him when the pager would go off, because he's slow and methodical and I'm young, rambunctious, want to get there. So we pull up at the station and I'm in my gear and he's still putting on his socks. It's a whole debacle, but I'm happy to have had that experience and that bonding with my father at that time. So.
Right. Okay. All right. One thing that kind of sparked my ears is you mentioned that you left one department to go to another for hazmat. Don't really hear very many people going like, yeah, I kind of love hazmat.
So yeah, I've always loved chemistry and hazmat ever since I was a kid. And when I started in Deerfield, and Deerfield Beach was amazing. I mean, I'm talking three station department, smaller department, very just not isolated. I wouldn't use the word isolated, but just tight knit, very tight knit department. Everybody knew each other, very close knit group. And when I left there, it was kind of bittersweet because those bonds were starting to develop, and I'm like, man, this is a good place to be. But that drive to do hazmat was just always there. So when Fort Lauderdale was hiring, I took that leap, and I'm glad I did because when I first started in Lauderdale, one of the first statements out of my mouth when we had our group during orientation was, "Hi, my name is Steve. I'm from Deerfield Beach as a firefighter, and I want to be in the hazmat team." And that was my intent. I just vocalized that. So very soon into that, I was able to get on the hazmat team, work with the current guys that were there who were absolutely amazing. And I just rolled with it. I got my everything from got my degree, my bachelor's in chemistry, became the hazmat coordinator later on, serve currently as a USAR hazmat specialist for Task Force 2 based out of the city of Miami. And now I'm a member of the IAFC hazmat committee. So I just kept taking it to the limit, man. And yeah, right. A lot of people don't want to do hazmat. I love it. And now that I'm in this new department without a hazmat team, that and we're looking into the future, I still find ways to get involved and stay involved because it's one of my passion areas.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to fast forward just a little bit. Upon actually getting your feet wet, entering your career department, was it everything you thought it would be?
That's an interesting question. So, was it everything I thought it would be? Wow. When you're asking that question, I don't know if I knew what to expect, quite frankly. I think that, like what we all do, we do our ride times in EMT school, and we see different departments from that vantage point. I think when I got hired in Deerfield as my first paid job, it was and it wasn't. Like I was running calls, I was getting to know the people. But I was missing, like I said, the reason I left wasn't because of the people. The people were amazing. It was because there was something I was missing. That was the hazmat side of things. And luckily, when I went to Lauderdale, there was so much more over there that I got to do that I wouldn't have had at that time to do in Deerfield. So I was able to meet the needs. So I guess my answer to that is, had I, and today this is a big deal for me because as we're hiring for this department, it's very important to me that people understand what they're getting into, that they've done the research, that they're matching up who they are and who they want to be with where they're wanting to go. It's a buyer's market right now, especially in the South Florida area. If you want to work for a very small, tight-knit, one station, two station, three station department, you can do that. If you want to work for a county-sized organization, a metro-sized organization, you can do that too. It's a buyer's market. But it has to work on both ends. The culture you possess has to match the culture of the department and vice versa. So I think looking back, I was in those situations where you take the first job you get, and that's what I did. And I'm happy I've worked in an amazing agency, but it just wasn't everything that I wanted to do. So when I went to Lauderdale, it met that need. I matched the person I was with my needs and goals with the department. And even when I left Fort Lauderdale, it was like a warm handoff. Like they had done for me, I'd done for them. Hey, great job. I'm moving on. It was like I left at the right time, if that makes sense.
Yes.
I don't know if I answered your question or not, but I think I did.
No, you did. No, you're fine. You're fine. Okay. So upon Fort Lauderdale getting some years under your belt there, how important was it for you to try to find those firefighters you wanted to emulate, the firefighters that had the same mindset as you? Because it's very easy, and this happens today, a very motivated, aggressive, gung-ho firefighter gets unfortunately put in with individuals that don't see the job like we should. So did you try to seek out those people that had that same mindset like you?
So I did. I will tell you that I think one of the mistakes I made early on in my career, especially with Lauderdale, was in some way, shape, or form, in my mind, I thought, I'm going to do this myself. I'm going to prove to them I could do this myself. And I didn't seek out as much mentorship from the people that I was around that I should have. In my mind, I was like, I'll show them I can do this. I'm going to prove to them. But in reality, I should have been having a lot more conversations with them, asking and trying to mentor and just diving deep into the people I was working with. Going back to the hazmat team I was on, man, these guys were just solid cats. They were good at their job. They knew what they were doing. They were firefighters. They knew what they had to do. They run a hazmat call. But more importantly, they were good people. And I learned a lot from them. I learned what a team was. They got me thinking from me, me, and I to us, we, team. So I'm glad that I had that experience with them. And after that, I think that's kind of what we do. We gravitate towards the people we want to either be like or that are have the same culture or vision that we do. And I've done that. Whether that's the people you're teaching with, the people you end up being the same station at, hazmat was a big thing for me. I think that going back to just the I guess the when I first started not having going transitioning from an I mentality to a we mentality was important. And now these days I focus on it a lot. I make sure I'm listening for those words. Even now, as people are asking about what we're doing over here in Jupiter, and I listen to their interest and why they want to come here. If it starts off with, well, it works for me and I retire here and I can do this, and I'm like, you're losing me, man. It has to be about, team and we, and we're going to be doing for the group and the residents and the organizations to give you back and servant leadership. So I'm glad for the experience because it helps kind of build who I am today, I suppose.
Okay. All right. And at what point in your career did you decide to start that transition of promoting?
So this is a good question. Now, I was always taught by my dad, take the promotions that are available to you. And I
Okay.
listen, I trust my dad. He's my mentor. I listen to everything he says. But there are certain things I look back, I'm like, you know what? I don't agree with this or I don't agree with that. Right? Like single digit number of things. And one of those has to do with promotions. For me, I think differently. I think you promote when you're ready to promote, not because just the opportunity is available. So for example, it's unfortunate that, especially in our area, like as an example, a lot of people in the South Florida area, when you get hired, you are immediately assigned to a rescue truck, a medical rescue truck, an ambulance. And that's, some people get into this job thinking, oh, I'm going to fight fire like in Backdraft or, Ladder 49 or whatever. Well, you're not. You're going to do a lot of things, a lot of it being medical. And that's actually a beautiful thing. But again, if your mindset is, ooh, I'm just going to be fighting fire, you probably not. And it's unfortunate that a lot of people are, let's say, promoting just to get off the box, just to get off rescue. And I listen, I've been there, okay? And as we build this culture here, we think about that a lot. Like, in other words, what do we do to encourage people to maybe want to spend a career in the box? How do we do that? How do we create an environment where it's okay and appreciated and valued to be that person that's assigned to the box and want to stay there for a while? But going back to your question, you promote when you're ready to promote, not when just these opportunities open up. The smartest thing I ever did, for an example, well, actually, it's a dichotomy. When I took my first lieutenant's test to be a lieutenant on the engine, and I got the testing done, and my name was on that list, it was like a wash. Like, oh my gosh, holy cow, this is real now. Like, I could be in that truck tomorrow as an upgrade. And that self-doubt started creeping in. Do I know everything? Have I been on enough calls? And I remember that was a big turning point for me to go, dude, I don't know everything. Let me start dialing things in. So I remember hyper focus on going to classes and seminars and conferences everywhere from Fire Rescue East all the way to Fire Rescue West in California, going to the free DHS funded courses in Pueblo and New Mexico and everywhere, just soaking myself up, and then learning, just taking a different viewpoint on the calls I was running on, not just to go, but to learn from them. Because now I'm an officer. I'm going to be an officer soon, right? So I think I may have taken the test a little bit sooner than I should have. It all worked out, but there was that realization. Conversely, when the first battalion chief's test opened up that I was able to take, I didn't take it because I wasn't ready. I had my own station, my own firehouse. I was a lieutenant with a great crew. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to stay here for a little bit. And I tell you, man, Danny, that was the smartest thing I ever did. I got to have my own station, my own crew, own experiences. We have this bond now that it took 3 years to build that still exists today because of that time of absorbing the position, running the calls, not rushing. And then when I took the battalion chief's test, I was ready. I was comfortable and I aced it. I got number one on the test, but I was ready at that time. I was ready to take that move up, but it was because I skipped the first test that was available. And even now with my promotions, I don't just because they're open doesn't mean it's time. It's are you ready? Are you prepared? Do you want that position? I think this is a whole rabbit hole question, but I hope the people that are listening understand that just because you're eligible, not necessarily may not be your time. In fact, if you do take it, the promotion, and you are promoted, are you putting yourself in a situation where you may never get to do anything that you wanted to have done again? So Enjoy that time as a firefighter. Enjoy riding backwards. Enjoy the rescue. Enjoy the box. Enjoy being a driver. Enjoy being an officer. But take it in, soak it in. Don't feel like you have to rush. Don't feel, because even now I look back, as we're hiring people, you could see it. As I'm going through people, going through the resume, you see the people that are rushed through and maybe didn't get the experience they could have gotten, and those that kind of took their time and just fleshed out their career in such a way that they've been there, they've done that. They have a lot more of those shared experiences that somebody that rushed through did. So.
Okay, I love the answer. Love the answer. I'm gonna kind of go back just a little bit. The notion of promoting to get off the box, through my experiences and my journey of being able to talk to so many people, there's pros and cons to it. So how are you looking at it, with your current organization now? Because it's one of those things, damned if you do, damned if you don't, if your department does their own transport. And some individuals come into this profession wanting to go to fires, but understand, okay, in order for me to get to where I want to really be, I have to do my time on the ambulance. So my question is, like, what's your take on organizations that have to do that and organizations that maybe don't really necessarily have to, if you can answer that.
So, if I'm hearing you correctly, I want to try to make sure I answer this question the right way. Are we talking about expectations? Are we talking about asking me in a different way, because I think I know where you're going with this, but I
Okay.
want to make sure I'm answering
So
it right.
in your
Hold on
opinion,
a second. Hold on a second.
No problem.
All right, I got you back.
Good.
Sorry. Yeah,
All right.
good.
No, all right. In your opinion, can that hurt certain departments when it comes to, hey, in order to come here, you're going to have to do your time on this, and then in order to get off, you have to promote?
Okay. So yeah, this is a good discussion. So I think that it's about expectations. I think that, again, this is a buyer's market right now, and if you're getting into this field, you have to understand where you are versus what you're going to be doing. So in the South Florida area, that's where I live. I've grown up here, born and raised. We know that if you get hired on in the Miami-Dade, Palm Beach County, Broward County area, you're going to be on a fire rescue department. You're going to be doing firefighting. You're going to be doing transport, medical transport. So generally speaking, we hire firefighter paramedics. We dropped that requirement down to firefighter EMTs because there's a shortage. But most departments have it there. If you're an EMT, you have to get your medic in a certain time frame, right? So the expectation, you have to make sure people understand coming in the door what they're going to be experiencing. In other words, being honest with people is very important. I hear this a lot. In some departments, and again, I get to interact with a lot of departments around here. Some of the frustrations I've heard come from, I feel like I was misled. I'm like, what do you mean? Well, they preached that I was going to be here in this department and we were going to be fighting fires every day. We're going to be doing VES and structure fires and high-rise fires. And in reality, I'm on the rescue riding a bunch of medical calls and occasionally I get a fire. Well, I think the expectation was a mismatch. In other words, they were given a false pretense. So, and there's nothing wrong with what we do, okay? It's how it's presented. So making sure people have a clear expectation of what this job entails is so important. So you don't get that mismatch. So you don't have that person that goes, well, I didn't know this was going to be life. Well, that's a problem. So making sure people understand what they're getting into, and then understanding to them that, hey, like riding the box is actually a beautiful thing. And many people that, I mean, listen, when you talk to like the guys I work with here, we love that we had that experience on the rescue truck, on the medical rescue truck, because it gave us the reps, it gave us the experience, it gave us the chance to talk to people. We're on everything from medical calls to fire calls to special operation calls, but you're out there, you're doing it, you're practicing what you went to school for. And when you do rise the ranks, you want to be in a position, whether it's training, admin, wherever, to be able to say, I've been there. I've done that. I can empathize with you guys who are now where I was 20 years ago. So that's important. And I think that when you explain it in those terms, it doesn't exactly make it all good, but at least it gives you some interpretation of the juice being worth the squeeze. In other words, yeah, you run a ton of calls on a regular basis on the rescue truck, but that's a good thing. you're practicing, you're meeting people, you're getting your reps in. That's a good thing. So I think that making sure people have that interpretation of things is important. But also there's the appreciation of the, since we're talking about the rescue, let's talk about that. I was talking to a couple guys on another podcast recently about some departments that really make sure they focus on their rescues. In other words, my buddy Mark in Fort Lauderdale, their rescue runs more than the engine, as normal happens, right? But he takes care of them. Every time they do something, every time they train together, they are training as a cohesive unit. They're doing things together. They're eating together. And when they're not eating because they're on a call, he's making sure he's monitoring the radio. Where are they? Keep their food warm. They're running multiple calls after lunch. Chief, can we take them out of service so they can eat, please? So he's taking care of them. So, and on calls and stuff, referring to them, hey, I may be a captain, but you're the rescue lieutenant. What do you think about this? You're the medical expert. What do I need to be thinking here? How can I support you? So it changes the dynamic when you appreciate and value those people on the box, because it's important. And that's just because you mentioned the rescue, that's just one of those things. But, one of my favorite things to do is talk to those guys that are on the rescue these days, the medical rescue, that have been on there for like 20, 25 years, and go, dude, how do you do it? What's the magic sauce that allows you to ride this unit as a career? And how do I replicate that? Like, what's special about what's your experience that makes that? And how do I bottle that?
But I think what's important is the fact that, like, that friend you mentioned, to me, that goes a very long way to do that, because you hear horror stories of, like, I know from my experience when I went up to DC to ride with a buddy of mine, like the crew on the medic unit there on the ambulance, they packed their lunch, and once they left, it was a while before you seen them come back in. So the fact that, he could call and be like, hey, can they go out of service to eat? Because it's one of those things I feel like gets lost or forgotten, is the fact that when you have a medic unit that busy, simple things as eating food, allowing them to get nu to f fuel their bodies back, can go unnoticed.
Oh yeah. That and having like when I first started in Lauderdale, that was us. We got beat up on the rescues all the time. And most of the stations I was at, they respected that. They were aware of that and they catered to it. But there's nothing more demoralizing that when you get back to a station, let's say it's a multi-company station and you're on the medical rescue, and you get back and food's over and you get the rescue rations, it's like it just whatever's left over, there's no thought put into it. That's a moral hit. That really doesn't feel good. But on conversely, if you're taken care of, if they're at least trying to take you out of service, they're thinking about you, they've got you on their minds, and maybe they set up, they put your food away and kept it warm or whatever. It was little things. Those little things matter. So it's just making sure people know they're being valued, know they're being thought about, know that they're part of the team, and we haven't forgotten about you. That's important.
Definitely. Okay. In your opinion, what's your definition of professionalism?
So it professionalism. So what do I consider a professional? I think that when I think about the word professional, I think about the people that model the behavior that's supposed to be the way we're supposed to be doing things. So if I'm a professional firefighter, I'm a professional firefighter paramedic, let's say in the state of Florida, I'm doing things the right way. I'm doing things for the right way, the right reasons. I'm modeling the behaviors that are I want to see in other people do. I'm thinking about the why and I do things. I'm thinking about 360 care. I'm not just thinking about, like, for example, I'm not just let's say I'm doing a VES or on a house fire, okay, and I bring out somebody from a VES. I'm not high five and I'm done. Well, what's the next care? What do I need to worry about the patient? Am I treating this person with medical care, a cyano kit, bringing this person out, get into the hospital, and then even then continue following up. Hey, I know you're out of the hospital. How are you doing? Hey, can we do anything for you? So I'm thinking about professionalism in terms of that 360 approach. I think that it goes kind of with integrity, like doing the right thing at the right time, saying the right thing at the right time when it needs to be said. I think about some of the people I mentioned hazmat before. And I thought about those leaders that I was initially exposed to and how they did the right thing. Their actions defined them. So in other words, it could be one of those situations where there's a weird policy or procedure that comes out, or there's layoffs happening, or a furlough days are being laid on people. And you look to your leaders. You look to your leaders and see what the response are. Well, the leaders I had early in my career were professionals. They responded professionally. They're like, well, this is happening. They didn't bitch and moan. They didn't scream and cry, oh, the chief sucks. They were professional about it. Like, okay, this is happening. This is how we're going to respond. But they did it in a professional way. They were true men, true women. They were just professionals, just the kind of people that were like adults about things and not children. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So I think that it's in the response. The professional way to do things is in the response. How you respond to something is going to define you, right? So, and I'm not talking about responding to a 911 call. I'm just talking about those situations that happen at the firehouse or on scene. How do you respond? Are you a grown-up when you respond? Are you a professional when you respond? Or are you kicking and screaming and making a fool of yourself? I try to think about that all the time, that when something hits me, whether it's a complaint from a citizen or a question from a resident or something that happens internally or whatever, how do I respond to it? And my default is I'm going to do it professionally. I'm going to do it morally, do it ethically, do it the right way, so that I'm modeling the behavior that I want to see in my team.
Love it. Okay. With your current role now, and I want to ask this question for those that listen and maybe want to pursue maybe applying to your organization that you guys are working on now. What are your expectations for this department that's being created?
Oh, that's a good one. Okay, so first of all, I love the word expectations. I think that, that when I look back and I look at any things that I struggled with, any personal issues, personnel issues, any situational issues, project issues, and when I look back and something didn't go as well as it should have, it was most of the time based on the fact that I didn't make my expectations clear, and there was some sort of mismatch from that point going forward. So expectations for this growing fire department, I got to tell you, man, we're doing something amazing here. We're building a fire department from the ground up. So right now, there's no like history because we're building it fresh. Now, the challenges are, myself, I have just shy of 30 years in the fire service. My boss, Chief Donato, has 43 years in the fire service. The people we just hired have a range from 20 to 30. So we have 150 years of experience between the five people that are already here and we're building on. So we have this unique opportunity to take what we know that works in the fire service and continue on those good things, and take what we know that didn't work, or some things that we just knew were the wrong ways, or traditions that were just ingrained that couldn't get away from. We don't have to deal with those. But in terms of expectations, so a couple of things. One, a buddy of mine was actually pretty spot on when he said this to me. He calls me up one day. He goes, "Hey, listen, I'm looking to maybe jump on board with you guys, but I think I know what to expect." I'm like, "Oh, really? Well, what are you going to expect?" And he goes, "Well, Steve, I know you, and you're a trainer, so every day is going to be a training day." And I'm like, "You're damn right. Every single day, you're going to be training on something. You're going to be drilling on something. Now, that could be a few minutes on a piece of equipment, or all day out of service in gear fighting fires or doing medical training, whatever it is. Yes, every day you're going to be training." He goes, "Okay, I got that." He goes, "And also, you're going to have us doing a lot of stuff in the community, like a lot of stuff, like HOA meetings, going to meet and greets, all these kinds of following up on patients from the shift before, everything." I'm like, yeah, they're going to know you by name. They're going to know you very personally. You're going to know your people. You're going to know this place intimately, and it's going to work both ways. You're going to have a very intimate relationship with the people you work with and the people that you serve." He goes, "Okay." He goes, "Then at night, you'll probably leave us alone." I'm like, "Yeah, at night, I'm going to leave you alone. I'll let you sleep." So that's one of the expectations. But most importantly, it goes back to how we respond. We're going to be a fire department that quite, and this is what my boss says all the time, and I love repeating it, that is loved by the people that we serve and that love coming to work. Like right now, I love what I do. I go home every day and my wife says, "Steve, you just don't stop talking about your job." And I'm like, "I know, I love it. I love what we're doing. I love that we're building here." And now my challenge is, how do I, with the team, how do we create an environment to where they feel the same way? That when they're leaving this job, when they go home, they're like, "Wow, that was awesome. I love the people I work with. I'm valued. I love the responses we went on. I learned something. I was able to deploy my skills. I made somebody's day better, and I want to go do it again. And how do we grow them? Like my vision of growth in the fire service has definitely morphed through the years. I realized that when you're done with this job, what's next? What's the next chapter going to be? And that's okay. So after you're done with a 20, 25, 30-year career, what's next? So the other expectation here is that you grow continuously, horizontally, vertically, as a human being, that you're getting better. You're not just checking off 30 CEUs every 2 years to maintain your paramedic certificate or just checking a box to get your fire training done. You're growing, you're learning, you're expanding so that when you do retire, when you do leave, when you do end this chapter and go to the next one, you're better. So it's just like the definition of legacy. In other words, leaving someplace better than you found it. How do we, as an organization, leave you better than we found you? How do we make you better? How do we get the best version of you to the you're wonderful through this career, you're happy, and you leave, and you're an advocate for us. You've had this great experience, but you're ready for whatever that next journey in life is, But and I could talk about this all day, you could tell, right?
No, it's
So,
good. It's good.
but we just are looking for people that are looking to serve the people of this community in every way, shape, or form, this 360 care, this just making sure that we're like, if you have a problem, what is it? It's your life, our mission. What are we doing? How can we help you? How can we help you today? So, and we can unpack that for the next hour and a half, but those are just some of the things that go into my mind as we're building this place.
Okay. No, I love it. I love the expectations. I'm going to go back with you being a former training chief as well. It's to me, for me in my personal opinion, it's mind-blowing that we have individuals that come into this profession that don't want to train, because if you're not training, you're not getting good at the job, and you will not be good if you never train and then expect, hey, well, but when that call hits, I'll be ready to go. You're just lying to yourself. So, with that being said, in your opinion, why is it important for firefighters to continually train? And as the training chief, what kind of things did you push out for your members to cultivate themselves? Because the position of chief of training, to me, sets the culture of the department. Yes, the fire chief has some say, but the chief of training, to me, has more meat and skin in the game.
Okay. And you're 100% right. Listen, training is a gift. It's a conduit. It's a path. It's a platform. It's a communication medium for the entire organization. Good fire chiefs, and great, I've never been a fire chief, but good chief officers understand the value that a good operating training bureau has as the pulse of their department. And if they're translating their needs or missions or priorities to the training bureau and they understand it, they're able to train the entire department. That's huge. That's huge. So I will tell you in my mind, and I mean, listen, we've seen this movie before too. In other words, you know how this goes sometimes. Hey guys, you guys are going to training today. Oh my
Yep.
God. Oh, Jesus Christ, I can't believe it. And then they get in the road, they get in their trucks, they're bitching, they get on scene. And when the training's done right, halfway through, they're starting to get it. Halfway, a little bit more, they're starting to inject things and starting to do teaching, and they're starting to put their experience on it. And by the end of the day, they're taking pictures, they're updating Facebook and Instagram, they're taking group shots, they hang at the station, they're in their gear, their sweat, they have that shared experience together, and everything's beautiful. But it's that classic progression when you tell them that. So first of all, it's the understanding from the training bureau that may happen, and that's your challenge. That's your challenge to try to navigate through that. How do you make it valuable to them to come out to the training? Are you respecting their experience? Are you giving them something valuable? Are they walking away with something tangible, or is it a waste of time? That's on the training bureau. They got to have a robust training program that's valuable to the organization and makes that person better. But the other thing is, you have to make it the standard. You have to make it the norm. You will train. So, for example, when I was at my firehouse for 3 years prior to going to DAZE, I made it known on day one. I made it known, guys, we're going to train every day. And they looked at me like I had an eggplant growing out of my forehead. They're like, what? Don't you know where we're at? We're at a busy station, Sean. I'm like, yeah, we're going to do it. And we did. And every day we trained. But by the end of that journey, One, they were happy to do it. They knew it was an expectation. They knew coming in, oh, we're going to do something today. But they learned, they grew. And some of the rewards of that were not only the shared experiences, the increase in skill level. I would get text, random text years later from my firefighter, like Dennis. He would say, hey, I used that technique that we trained on this one day at a house fire recently. I'm like, cool. I had two drivers that were firefighters with me at that station who were later drivers, both say to me at different times, you know what? I'm so glad we did all that training. I'm like, you were? And they're like, well, not really, but it sure did make me a better driver.
Right.
Listen, proof's in the pudding, you know? So you make it the norm. You have to be excited about training. You have to be, there's whole, training's a whole separate topic, but you have to make it the norm. And when they're there, make it so they're valued. Make it so that it's valuable. They walk away with something. But dude, you're right. In terms of the people that don't want to train, addressing that is important. In other words, sometimes it takes a conversation, and ignoring it's not the way to go about doing it. If you have, and I'm just thinking of multiple examples here, if you have those situations where you have a person that's just not into it, well, seek them out. And not like you're trying to combat them, but like you're genuinely curious. You're like, you want to know what's going on. Hey, listen, I'm the training bureau. I want to make your job better, but I'm feeling some resistance. Man, help me unpack that. What's going on here? And oftentimes I would argue that that conversation will lead to a positive result. Now they might not be jumping and bailing out windows every day, but at least you're on the same page. You're trying to find out, trying to the root cause of this. And if you're trying to do that with those that maybe don't want to train, and you're taking the initiative to have the conversation, to start the dialogue, that's modeling communication. That's modeling professional. You asked about professional, right? That's professional. Not just ignoring it, going, oh, that's the guy that doesn't want to train. You're going, hey, man, I'd like to talk to you for a second. I respect you. I appreciate you. What's going on here that I'm missing? That's professional. So that's my two cents on
Love
that.
it. With that question, I'll transition to this that goes hand in hand. When you held that position, unfortunately, I've seen it and I've talked to others that experience it, individuals that come on the department with good means, okay? They're good individuals, but they're just not cutting it. And sometimes you have organizations that will leave them be because they need butts in the seats. And to me, that right there, you're setting yourself up for failure. And firefighters, or I don't want to say firefighters, some chief officers don't want to think of the bad things that could happen. But if you have an individual that's on an apparatus, that's not into it, that doesn't want to train, that can't do the job, but hey, nobody else is applying, we're going to hold with what we got. To me, you're hurting the department, the crew, and as a chief, like if I was a chief, you're setting yourself up for if something, God forbid, happens bad, like you have to deal with that. So individuals that are not cutting it, it's an uncomfortable situation, uncomfortable topic. But like you said, if you don't address it, you're not being professional.
So I'll say this, and again, I've been on that. I've had to deal with that many times through my career as training chief. I've had to be in the situation where I'm talking to somebody, letting them know that this is their last day because they're not meant for this career. But I will say this though, and you mentioned this just a second ago, that it's uncomfortable. It's like not the most people are uncomfortable with that idea. I got to tell you, when if you've done it right. If you've objectively looked at those persons, you determine that this person is not meeting that criteria. They're a hazard to themselves or a hazard to the department. They're not the right match. And you've done all your research and realized this is the way to go. Then, quite frankly, there should be no emotion attached. There should be no emotion attached. It's simply a mismatch. Like this person was never supposed to be here. You've validated that this they're not meeting the standards, they're not meeting the times, they're not able to whatever it is. You've taken your process, they're not meeting the standards. Hey, it's time to have that talk, chief. We need to let the person go. Now, I've been on both sides of that too, where I've had the chief support and the chief's not support. But going back to being professional, our job here in the training bureau is to make sure that the people that are going through our program meet those qualifications, those standards to be a firefighter in the organization that they're there for. It's hard to it's not to me it was never difficult. Once I got to that point where I'm like, yeah, this person's not right for this job, not right for us. It was simply a matter of having that discussion and talking to the chief, getting the approval, and then say, "Hey, this is your last day." And there's emotional content on the other side of the room. They're upset. They're wondering why. But in reality, you're helping everybody. That person knows they need to get better. They maybe this isn't the right department for them. Maybe they need to increase physically or whatever it is. But you're helping them because what if they do get on? There's the risk. I mean, where are they going to go? Are they going to get better or not? Are they short of training where they're going to get worse? Are they not physically ready to perform? Are you putting your own people in jeopardy? Are you putting your own citizens in jeopardy? Those are risks. And yeah, I've had situations where I've had chiefs go, "Yeah, no, Steve, we're going to keep this person. Hey, I've given you my interpretation. I've given you my thoughts. This is my recommendation. But your directive is what? Okay, understood. I hear the directive. You've heard my side. Mission understood. Orders are given. I got it." Now, that's when it comes to, well, what are you going to do? Are you going to be, F this? And listen, we all have bosses. We all have directives. Sometimes you have to deal with those situations and make the best out of the situation. It ain't ideal. Listen, life ain't perfect, right? But I've also had situations where chiefs have supported that. And it's because we had the background. We had the data to support the decision to let this person go. Everything was there. And then it made it easy for them. They're looking at it going, "Oh, well, this makes too much sense. Would you want to go on today or tomorrow?" So a lot of it's on you. A lot of it's on the onus is on you to make sure it's not just a subjective, "I don't like this guy," but no, here's the information. There's the data that you need to understand. This is the reason why I'm recommending termination or separation. Once you've done your job the right way, it's so much easier to sell. So, and again, I'm just one person. Those have been my experiences. But like I said, at the end of the day, if you do have that person, especially in the beginning of their career, that is not meeting that standard, you've checked it, you've gone through your process. Truthfully, there's no emotion attached. They can or they can't. And if they can't, that's where you have the conversation with the bosses and show them why.
Okay. All right. A lighter topic, less heavy. Which characteristic holds more weight in your opinion? Years of service, education, work ethic, or on-the-job experience?
So years of service, education, work ethic, or on-the-job experience. Okay. So I will say that I've definitely evolved in this as well. I'm a big education guy. I have a bachelor's degree, I have a master's degree. I love going to school. But I got to tell you, even I will admit that the stuff I learned in classes and seminar or in school, it looks good on paper a lot of times. A lot of it doesn't translate to what I'm doing. So my mind these days is quite frankly, to your question here, is that work ethic combined with that experience, like what experience they bring to the table. But most importantly, it's who they are as a person. It's the work ethic, the character. If I got a good person, a good ethical, moral person, strong work ethic, that cat can learn anything. We could teach that cat, you know? Conversely, if I got a rock star status resume, CV, crazy experiences, but they're a jerk and they don't have the right culture, they're not coming. You're not on this boat, man. So I go back to the person. I go back to that person. Work ethic's big for me. The character in a person, are they doing the right thing? That's what we need. That is truly what we need. The rest of it, even years of service. I mean, that could be misconstrued. Years of service, you could be doing 1 year consistently over 20 years, or have you grown through the course of your journey? So, I've seen people with less experience year-wise outdo tenured people just because they're the right person for the gig. They have that mindset. Their ethic is there. I do love job experience. I think it's valuable. I think it's tremendous. But are they a good person? That really what it comes down to. I can't get away from that. I like when we're interviewing people, whether it was in Fort Lauderdale or even here, do I like the person? Will other people get along with this person? Not exactly. What I'm not saying is, are they a yes person? Are they a yes man or yes woman? No, that's not the case. In fact, directly opposite. We want people that challenge you and challenge us professionally doing so. That are making trying to make informed decisions and having those conversations that up the chain, may differ from the rest of us, but do it the right way. But yeah, it goes down to me is that character and the work ethic. It really does.
A personal question for you. I'm sure, coming in very young, as you start to mature, you get years under your belt, the education, the outside training, the classes and things and education of that nature. Did you ever see yourself in the position that you are in right now?
No. And well, first of all, what I'm doing now is definitely a unicorn experience. Like building a fire department from scratch doesn't happen every day. So I don't think a lot of people think they're ever going to be in this position. I will tell you that through the years, though, I think that we all start, or at least, okay, let me say, not we all, but I know I started young thinking, one day I'll be fire chief. And then really quickly into the career, I'm like, you know what? I don't know if I want to do that. I like certain things. I'm good being here or there. And through the course of a career, wherever I find myself that I'm really happy and enjoying and providing value, maybe that's where I stay. Now, it just so happened with me, I got to my certain rank, did what I needed to do for a certain amount of time, enjoyed it, loved it, and was curious about the next rank. I wanted to take the next jump. And that just was my transition. Some people are firefighters and that's all they want to do. God bless them. We need those. Awesome. Some people like the box and that's all they want to do. Great. Awesome. Some people love being a driver. Cool. That's just wonderful. But I think that for me, I look back and I will tell you that I was a victim of imposter syndrome. Okay. I was definitely a victim of that for a good portion of my career, thinking, okay, am I ready for this? I don't know if I could do this. I don't know if I, and up until relatively recently too. And it took some several people that I trust implicitly and some tough conversations and the tough talks and crucial conversations for them to say to me, "Shut up, Steve. You're good. You know you're good." And after them kind of just reinforcing what I've already known, I'm like, I can do this. I can take on this position or that committee or this challenge here in this fire department as we're building it from scratch. So I think that no, I didn't know I'd be here, but I love what I'm doing. I love the opportunity. I love this petri dish of leadership and growth that we're in right now. And I know what this is going to be, and I love it. And I'm excited to see where this goes and be part of that, So, but yeah, everybody's journey is different, man. Like I said, some people are happy where they're at. Cool. But I think another thing is to answer your question, Dan, is that one of our jobs here is to encourage the best out of people. And sometimes they don't know that they could be an officer. They don't know they could be a chief. They don't know they could be a committee head of something or other. They don't know they could be in the USAR team or a special ops guy. Encouraging them and showing them what they can do is also important. So, like for example, when we hire people here, we're hiring people for the position they're at, knowing that they're going to be upgrading to the next position. So we need people that can do their job and the job in front of them. That's the expectation going forward. So anyway.
And how important is it to have that circle of individuals that can tell you things like that? Because like the fire service is the greatest thing, but can also be so detrimental. Firefighters can be so cruel to their own. And having that circle of brothers and sisters that gave you that advice, like, hey, listen, sometimes you need to hear things you don't want to hear. Those are the people you need around you, not people that are going to tell you every single time, no, you're doing great, even though it's like, no, you're really messing up, but I don't have the heart to tell you. So, the adage or the saying, brotherhood's dead. How important is it for others to find individuals that they can share, their feelings with?
It's critical. It's critical today. It is critical that we find those individuals around us that we can confide in, that we can have as accountability partners, people that can help make things make sense to us when we don't know understand what they are. Like for example, for me, I've got several people that I consider like I got an accountability buddy, I got a communication buddy, I got a person that's the king of analogies that makes me make sense to things. So I have those people at my beck and call because I need that. But through a course of a career, I've learned to just rely on those people. I got one buddy, my buddy Garrett from Fort Lauderdale. I call him the analogy king because every time I don't understand something, I'll call my buddy Garrett and go, "Dude, this is happening. I don't understand." He'll go, "Well, think of it this way," and he'll make an analogy, and I'm like, "Oh, oh, I get it now, you know? And I have accountability partners. Like I'll have my buddy Mark and some other people that I respect. I'll call them and just I'll ask for a report card. Like, hey, listen, how am I doing with this? And I know those people are going to say, well, this is good and this is good, but really you need to work on this. And you have to be an adult, like a professional, to take that kind of criticism, that kind of critique. I need that. I don't want it. I need it. I need to know that I'm not communicating right, that I should have said this when I should have said that. It's critical to have those people to be in your corner to give you that feedback to make sure you're on the straight and narrow to if you can do something better. My wife is like that. Every time I'm like, for example, doing a presentation, I'm putting together a keynote or a presentation, my wife will look at it and she'll be harsh with me to almost like I'm hurt. Like what? She'll like, well, I don't understand this. This doesn't make sense to me. I'll get mad at first, but then I'll tone it down and go, well, hold on. She's helping me. She's really helping me. So, it's important to have those people around you. And you're right. They can't be the people that are just an echo chamber. They can't just be like, oh yeah, you're right. This place does suck. Or, oh yeah, you're doing just fine. I need critique. I need some, tell me what I can do to improve. Tell me how this can be better. Don't bullcrap me. I don't need that. We don't have time for that. So it's critical, man. And finding those people is a gift. And once you do find them, you hold on to them tight, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. You mentioned communication. It's my opinion through the travelings and like I said, discussions of other individuals, successful departments have communication. And with what you and your administration are doing with Jupiter, it sounds like your command staff are all on the same page to get a specific standard and task done with Jupiter. So how important is communication?
So I said this once in Fort Lauderdale during COVID when I was EMS chief. I'll be criticized if I over communicate, but I will be crucified if I under communicate. Okay. So by default, over communication is for me just the default setting. Now I don't always do that. I don't always win. I'm not perfect. I'm human like everybody else is. But we're trying to put together systems here that ensure good communication. Okay, whether it's regular meetings, the proper meetings, and there's books that can, there's all these great things on how to make the proper meeting. We just got done reading Ginconi's book, Death by Meeting, I think it's called,
Okay.
just to make sure our meetings are productive and such. But in terms of communication, whether it's social media, putting stuff out there on a regular basis, the right type of social media through a community relations department, internal communication, having meetings, and not even meetings, but just like activities that bring us closer together, like just activities that allow us to get to know each other better. And especially as we're growing, that's important to know the team at a very intimate level because we're the baseline, we're the base of what's going to be a larger organization. So really just opening up those doors. And I think that like what else I love to do is we brainstorm a lot. Like it's a normal thing now that I'll walk in the morning, I'll walk into my other deputy's office and I'll just start whiteboarding things. Like, hey, this was on my mind this morning. I'll put it on the board and we'll just go to town. Just leadership discussions, ideas for this, ideas for that. I love it. But most importantly, I think my fire chief demonstrates a lot of these amazing talents. He got a lot of experience, but he's willing to listen. He's willing to take in all of our input, and he's not so set in his ways that he's not going. He won't go, oh, that's interesting. I didn't think of it that way. We got to do this now. So that ability to make informed decisions but pivot if needed amongst us in a professional way is just it's great. But you're right in terms of communication. They always say that, right? Like, you know what the problem with this place is? Nobody communicates. And you got to think, how is that possible these days? Everybody's got cell phones and TikTok and Instagram and all these different ways to communicate. How is that possible? The last thing I'll say on this is I think that it's important to default to communication. So for me, I'm big on face to face, and I'm big on just trying to default to asking a question. So if I'm curious, if I haven't talked to somebody in a while, I see them in the office, I may start with just a general question, which opens up a dialogue, and then we start dialogue and then communicating and whatnot. But defaulting to communication is important. Not neglecting it, not avoiding communication, but having the talks that need to be had when they need to be had is important. And we're establishing that right now. You know, every time there's a situation where maybe there's a resident that doesn't understand what we're doing, we address it, we find them, we talk to them about it. an HOA was like, "Hey, can you explain that to us?" We're there the next day trying to explain what we're doing and why we're doing it. Yeah, so those are just some of the things I think about. But you're right, in terms of communication, you have to be defaulting to communication, not as a response, but just like being the person to start the communication and lead communication on a regular basis, consistently.
Right. Okay. As we kind of wrap up, I just have a couple questions, and not anything like deep diving into what you all are doing, but at, once everything is complete, how many stations are you, yeah, how many stations will Jupiter be?
So Jupiter is going to be three firehouses in total. So right now we're building two of those firehouses right now. We'll be moving into one that's already currently there when we take over take service on in October of 26. So we'll have three firehouses at that time, three-person rescue trucks, three engines, and a ladder truck. And then from there we go from there. We got a lot of great plans in the future, like a ton of things. A lot of it, some is out there on the website, some is out there, some is in-house, but man, the future is bright. It's going to be amazing.
Okay. And only answer if you can.
Yeah.
What will your minimum staffing be across your apparatus?
Right. So, like I said, it'll be three people on the rescue with a lieutenant, it'll be a captain on the engine and the ladder, three people as well. Actually, the ladder is going to be four personnel. And that fourth personnel, we are looking to find a way to creatively work with our police department in staffing a fire, or not a fire boat, but a police boat that's going to be like a response unit for the waterways. So we're putting that together right now because we know the waterways around here are a huge issue for us. It's on our minds. And then from there in the future, we have training bureau, EMS bureau. But the future is we're designing this for what a fire department should look like in 2026. So we're thinking about community paramedicine and mobile integrated healthcare and those kind of things. So, but to start off, that's going to be our staffing. Yeah.
And true engine, two truck culture, or are you guys still working with that through that?
So when you say like it's going to be the fire, like EMS fire, like fire-based EMS model right now.
Okay.
I know some departments that are doing just that. We're not there. We're not going to be doing that yet, or we're not doing that, let's say. So you can still cross staff engine rescue and ladder and rescue and vice versa. But yeah, so we'll still have EMS on the ALS engines and ALS ladder truck.
Okay. All right. And it sounds like with everything we talked about, you're going to have three firehouses, not three fire stations, because of just how you guys are trying to build the culture, the standard. This is how it's going to be. This is how we want to work as a family to integrate with the community.
It's interesting you said that because I had that conversation with one of the people from planning and zoning when I first started. And we had that conversation about, well, is it a fire station and a firehouse? Now, because of the consultants' work that was done and a lot of things that are already in place, it will say fire station. But I made it very clear to them that what that looked like in terms of why we internally will call it a firehouse. Because a lot of what we're doing here is interpreting or translating what a fire department should look like because they don't know. When we talk about a firehouse, I'm like, guys, you have to understand that we're together for 24 hours. We work together, sleep together, eat together. We get to know each other very intimately. We know each other's families. We're doing off-duty things together. So essentially, it's a house. It's where we come to live together for a whole shift, if not more, depending on overtime and all that kind of stuff. So when you explain it like that to them, they're like, oh, okay. And those conversations lead to, oh, I didn't realize that. So they're changing the size of the kitchen because they know how important that is to us. They're changing parking spots because they didn't realize, oh, we have shift change. So you don't need 10 spots, you need 20 spots.
Right.
So interpreting that to them is important because this is going to be a first impression for a lot of these people in the town that have never seen their own fire department. So they need to know what this looks like. And quite frankly, we're going to model that behavior of what one should look like in terms of that 360 degree care, that following up with patients, that really just getting to know the people at a very, very close level. But yeah, so in terms of that firehouse thing, I remember explaining that to the Parks and Rec people, and they definitely appreciated that.
Okay. And it sounds like you kind of do your own little traveling speaking. So if somebody were to wanted to get a hold of you, how would they do that?
I do a lot with fire engineering, so I'm doing a lot of articles, and I teach at FDIC. So I'm always available through there. I do one of the podcasts through them, Perspectives on Leadership. So we do a monthly podcast as well. We kind of talk about what we're talking about here, just to take a topic and deep dive on it. But they can get with me with my email address. It's my full name with my middle initial. So it's StephenFShaw@me.com. So it's Stephen, the letter F, Shaw, SHAW at me.com. And contact me. It's hard for me to get around these days because we're
So
building a
busy,
fire department. So everything's really focused on here. It's focused on Jupiter. It's focused on the people, the residents, the businesses, the building of the fire department to match their needs. It's a lot of work, man, but it's so rewarding. It's so rewarding.
And for those that might want to know about Jupiter, how would they go about finding that info? 'Cause
Good
I'm
question.
trying to do the
Good
shameless
question.
plug and everything else.
No, good question. If they go to Jupiter Fire Rescue and go to the town's website, everything that we are doing is there. I mean, everything. How to contact us, look at documents from where we started up until now, social media through Facebook and Instagram, everything is out there. We are very forward facing. Everything that we've done is public record. It's all there. And if people are interested in looking at a position here, because, dude, we have a ton of people that are reaching out to us all the time. I'm having phone calls every single day, every day, with people that are interested. There's an interest. There's an interest part of the email. They drop their email. They can get on our list. We can communicate with them. But yeah, there's a lot to break down here, and a lot of people have a lot of questions. So I'm excited to answer those questions and excited to engage in dialogue about what we're doing here.
Okay. And so, Chief, you said you all go live in 2026, correct?
Next year. Yep.
Next
Yep.
year, boots on the
2026.
ground,
Yep.
trucks on the road. So for me, I wish you guys the best. It sounds like what you're doing definitely is unheard of, but you're setting up your own history for Jupiter. And it sounds like it's a good thing with the way family standards, expectations, physical fitness training, everything that firefighters that truly love the job want to hear. So fantastic. I'm not trying to give you all the credit. I know it's a team effort
The team effort,
with your
100%.
command staff, but I also wanted to say thank you for taking time out of your day to do this.
No, man, listen, thanks for having me. I appreciate any venue that we can talk shop like this, that people are listening and get something out of and glean something out of. I'm all about, man. It's all about giving back, right?
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of podcasts out there, but that's a good thing because sometimes you hear something in a different way from somebody else that means more or sticks more with it than somebody else. So these conversations are great. And anytime I get to talk about this place, man, I'm all about it. So I appreciate the opportunity as well, man.
Sir, thank you. You have a great day.
All right, you too.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.